This is cassette number 14.
The pay is less, Ishak said. Richard brushed the iron and ore dust from his hands and rear of his pants. What's the difference? They just take it from me anyway and give it out. I'm not really losing any pay. Other people are losing my pay. Ishak chuckled and clapped Richard on the shoulder. You are the only one around here I can count on, Richard. You are different than the others. I feel I can talk to you, and it won't drift to other ears. I wouldn't do that to you. I know. That's why I tell you what I don't tell the others. I am expected to be equal and to work like anyone else, but I am also expected to provide jobs. They took my business, but they still expect me to run it for them. Crazy world. You don't know the half of it, Ishak. So what about this wagon loading job? What is it you need done? The blacksmith out at the site is dealing me a fit. Why? He has orders for tools, but he has no iron. Lots of people are waiting on things. He swept a hand out at the rack of iron. Most of this is what was ordered last autumn. Last autumn! It's nearly spring, and it's only now come in. It's all been promised to those who ordered it before. So why did it take so long for it to get here? Ishak slapped his forehead. Maybe you are an ignorant farm boy. After all, where you been? Under rocks? You can't just get things because you want them. You got to wait your turn. Your order must pass before the review board. Why? Why? Is that all you know? Ishak sighed and said something under his breath about the Creator testing his patience. He slapped the back of his fingers to the palm of his other hand as he explained it to Richard. Because you've got to think of others, that's why. You got to take other people's needs into consideration. You have to consider the good of everyone. If I get all the runs picking up and delivering the iron, then what chance have others who want to do the same? If I have all the business, that's unfair. It would put people out of work. What's available has to be divided up. The Board of Supervision must make sure everything is equal to all. Some people can't handle the orders so fast as I can, or they have trouble. Or they can't get workers, or their workers have troubles, so I got to wait until they can catch up. It's your business, why can't... Why? Here, take this order. I don't need to have that blacksmith come all the way down here again and yell at me. He's in trouble with his orders, and he needs the iron. Why is he in trouble? I thought everyone had to wait their turn. Ishak lifted an eyebrow and lowered his voice. His customer is the retreat. The retreat, what's that? The retreat. Ishak spread his arms, indicating something big. That's the name of the place being built for the emperor. Richard hadn't known the name. The emperor's new palace was the reason for all the workers coming to Al-Turang. He supposed it was the reason Nikki had insisted they come to the city, too. She had some interest in having him be part of the grand project. He assumed it was a grotesque sense of irony. "The new palace is going to be huge," Ishak said, waving his arms again. "A lot of work for a lot of people. It will be work for years building the retreat. So when the goods are for the order, then you had better deliver, I take it." Ishak smiled and dipped a deep nod. "Now you are starting to understand, Mr. Richard, why? The blacksmith is working directly from the orders of the builders of the palace, who report to the highest people. The builders need tools and things made. They don't want to hear excuses from a lowly blacksmith. The blacksmith doesn't want to hear excuses from me, but I have to go by what the review board says. He doesn't. He goes by what the palace says. I'm in the middle. Ishak paused when one of the other loaders came down the aisle with a piece of paper. Ishak read the paper the man gave him, while the man gave a sidelong look at Richard. Ishak sighed and gave brief directions to the man. After he was gone, Ishak turned back to Richard.
I can only transport what the review board allows me to move. That paper just now.
It was instructions from the board for me to hold a shipment of timbers to the mines because the load was going to go to a company that needs the work.
You see, I can't put other people out of business by being unfair and delivering more than they do, or else I have trouble, and I get replaced by someone who will not be so unfair to his competitors. Oh, it's not like the old days when I was young and foolish.
Richard folded his arms.
You mean to say that if you do a good job, you get in trouble, just like I did? Good job? Who's to say what is a good job? Everybody's got to work together for the good of everybody. That is a good job, if you help your fellow man.
Richard watched a couple of men off in the distance, loading a wagon with charcoal.
You really don't believe that mouthful of mush, do you, Ishak?
Ishak sighed in a long-suffering manner.
Richard, please, load the wagon when you get to the foundry, and then go with the wagon out to the retreat and unload it at the blacksmith shop. Please, don't get sick on me, or get a bad back, or have infirm children in the middle of the run. I don't need to see the blacksmith again, or I will have to go swimming with an iron bar around my neck.
Richard grunted a laugh. My back is feeling fine.
Good. I'll get a driver over here to drive the wagon.
Ishak waggled a cautionary finger.
And don't ask the driver to help load or unload. We don't need that kind of grievance brought up at the next meeting. I had to beg Jory not to lodge a complaint after I asked him to help me unload the wagon that day in the rain, when the wheels broke. The day you helped me get the load to the warehouse, remember?
I remember.
Please don't give Jory any trouble. Don't touch the reins. That's his job. Be a good fellow, then. Get the iron loaded and unloaded so that blacksmith doesn't come to see me again.
Sure, Ishak. I won't make any trouble for you. You can trust me.
There's a good fellow.
Ishak started away but turned back.
It was not so much trouble on a farm, am I right?
No, it wasn't. I wish I was back there now. Before he got far, Ishak turned back once more.
You be sure to bow and scrape if you see any of those priests, you hear?
Priests? What priests? How will I know them?
Brown robes and creased caps, oh, you'll know them. You can't miss them. If you see any, you be on your best manners. If a priest suspects you of having an improper attitude toward the Creator or such, he can have you tortured. The priests are Brother Narev's disciples.
Brother Narev?
The High Priest of the Fellowship of Order.
Ishak waved his arms impatiently.
I have to get Jory to come with the wagon. Please, Richard, do as I ask. That blacksmith will feed me to his forge if I don't have that iron out there today. Please, Richard, get that load out there.
Please. Richard gave Ishak a smile in order to put his mind at ease.
You have my word, Ishak. The blacksmith will have the iron.
Ishak heaved a sigh and hurried off to find his driver. Chapter 48. It was late in the muggy afternoon by the time they made it to the site of the retreat. Sitting in the wagon beside Jory as they cleared the top of the final hill, Richard was awestruck by the sight. It was beyond huge. He couldn't imagine how many square miles had been cleared. Gangs of thousands of men, looking like ants spread out below, worked in lines with shovels and baskets, reshaping the contour of the land. Jory was disinterested in the construction, and only spat over the side, offering the occasional, "I suppose," to some of Richard's questions. The foundation was still being laid in deep trenches, enabling Richard, looking down from the road, to see on the ground the outline of the future structure. It was hard to fathom how enormous the building was going to be. Seeing the specks moving slowly beside it, it was hard to keep in mind that they were men. For sheer size, the structure would rival anything Richard had ever seen. There were miles of grounds and gardens going in. Fountains and other towering structures along entrance roads were beginning to be erected. Sweeping stretches of mazes were being constructed with hedges. Hillsides were dotted with trees that had been planted according to a grand plan. The retreat faced a lake in what was to be that majestic park. The short side of the main building was to run a quarter mile along the river. Stone pilings marched partway out into the river, with a series of connecting arches just starting to be constructed. Apparently, part of the palace was to extend out over the water, with docks for the emperor's pleasure craft. Across the river lay more of the city. On the palace side of the river, too, the city spread all around, though at a great distance from the retreat. Richard couldn't imagine how many buildings and people had been displaced for the construction. This was to be no distant and remote emperor's palace, but rather it was set right in the center of Altuerang. Roads were being paved with millions of cobbles, giving the multitudes of citizens of the order access to come and see the grand structure. There were already crowds of people standing behind rope barricades, watching the construction. Despite the poverty of the old world, it would appear that this grand palace was to be a crown jewel of unsurpassed splendor. Stone of various kinds lay in great piles. In the distance, Richard could see men working at cutting it into the required shapes. The heavy afternoon air rang with the faraway knells of hundreds of hammers and chisels. There were stockpiles of granite and marble in a variety of colors, and massive quantities of limestone blocks. Special quarry wagons waited in serpentine columns to deliver yet more. The long blocks of stone called lifts were slung under heavy beams that bridged the front and rear axles. Huts and great open shelters had been built for the stone workers so they could work no matter the weather. Timber was stickered in row upon row of huge stacks covered with purpose-built roofs. The overflow was covered in canvas. Small mountains of materials for mortar were scattered around the foundation, looking like anthills, the illusion aided by all the dark specks of men moving about. Away from the site itself, on a road that snaked its way along the side of a hill, along a small city of new work buildings overlooking the site, lay the blacksmith shop. It was quite large, compared with such places Richard had seen before. Of course, Richard had never seen anything on this scale being built. He had seen grand places that already existed. To see one just beginning was a revelation. The sheer scale of everything was disorienting. Jory expertly backed his team, putting the rear of the wagon right at the double doors standing open into blackness. "Here you be," Jory said. It was a long speech for the lanky driver. He pulled out a loaf of bread and a waterskin filled with ale, and climbed down from the wagon to find a place farther down the hill, where he could sit and watch the building, while Richard worked at unloading the iron. The blacksmith's shop was dark and stifling hot, even in the outer cluttered stockroom. Like all blacksmith shops, the walls in the workroom were covered in soot. Windows were kept to a minimum, mostly located overhead and covered with shutters, so as to keep it dark in order to more easily judge the nature of the glowing metal. Despite being recently built for the work at the palace, the blacksmith's shop already looked 100 years old. Nearly every spot held some tool or other in a dizzying array and variety. There were rows of tools, piles of them. The rafters were hung with tongs and firepots and crucibles and squares and dividers and contraptions like huge insects which looked to be used for clamping pieces together. Low benches, seemingly cobbled together in haste, were hung all around with long-handled dies of every sort. Some benches held smaller grindstones. Slots around some tables held hundreds of files and rasps.
Some of the low tables were covered in a jumble of hammers in such variety as Richard had never imagined, their handles all sticking out, making the tabletops look like huge pincushions. The floor was choked with clutter, boxes overflowing with parts, bars, rivets, wedges, lengths of iron stock, clippings, pry bars, pole hooks, dented pots, wooden jigs, tin snips, lengths of chain, pulleys, and a variety of special anvil attachments. Everything was covered with soot or dust or metal filings. Broad, short barrels full of liquid sat around the anvils, where men hammered on glowing iron held in tongs, flattening, stretching, cutting, squaring, clipping. Glowing metal hissed and smoked in protest as it was quenched in the liquid. Other men used the horns of their anvils to bend metal that looked like bits of sunset held captive in tongs. They held up those fascinating bits and matched them to patterns, hammered on the metal some more, and checked it again. Richard could hardly think in all the noise. In the darkness, a man worked a big bellows, putting all his weight on the downstroke. The blast of air made the fire roar. Charcoal overflowed from baskets sitting wherever there had been room to put them. Cubby holes held pipe and odd scraps of metal. Metal hoops leaned against benches and planks. Some of the hoops were for barrels. Bigger ones were for wagon wheels. Tongs and hammers lay here and there on the floor where men had dropped them in the haste of battle with the hot iron. The whole place was as agreeable a clutter as he had ever seen. A man in a leather apron stood not far away at a door to another workroom. He held out a chalkboard covered with a maze of lines as he studied a large contraption of metal bars on the floor in the room beyond. Richard waited, not wanting to interrupt the man's concentration. The sharply defined muscles of his sooty arms glistened with sweat. The man tapped the chalk against his lip as he puzzled, then swiped a line clean on the board and drew it again, moving its connecting points. Richard frowned at the drawing. It looked familiar somehow, even though it was no recognizable object. "Would you be the master blacksmith?" Richard asked when the man paused and looked over his shoulder. The man's brow seemed enduringly fixed in an intimidating scowl. His hair was cropped close to his skull, a good practice around so much fire and white-hot metal, adding to his menacing demeanor. He was of average height and sinewy, but it was his countenance that made him look big enough for any trouble that might come along. By the way the other men moved and glanced at this man, they feared him. Taken by inexplicable compulsion, Richard pointed at the line the man had just drawn. "That's wrong. What you just did is wrong. You have the top end right, but the bottom should go here, not where you put it." He didn't so much as blink.
"Do you even know what this is?"
"Well, not exactly, but I—"
"Then how can you presume to tell me where to put this support?"
The man looked like he wanted to stuff Richard in the forge and melt him down. "Offhand, I don't know exactly. Something just tells me that—"
"You had better be the man with the iron."
"I am," Richard said, glad to change the subject and wishing he had kept his mouth shut in the first place. He had only been trying to help. "Where would—"
"Where have you been all day? I was told it would be here first thing this morning. What did you do? Sleep till noon?"
No, sir. We went right to the foundry first thing. Ishak sent me right there at dawn, but the man at the foundry was having problems because—"
"I'm not interested. You said you had the iron. It's already late enough. Get it unloaded."
Richard looked around. Every spot seemed occupied. "Where would you like it?" The master blacksmith glared around at the crammed room as if he expected some of the piles to get up and move for him. They didn't.
"If you'd have been here when you were supposed to be here, you could have put it out there, just inside the door in the outer supply room. Now they brought that big rock sled that needs welding, so you will have to put the iron in the back. Next time, get out of bed earlier."
Richard was trying to be polite, but he was losing his patience with being castigated because the blacksmith was having a troubled day. "Ishak made it quite clear that you were to get iron today, and he sent me to see to it. I have your iron. I don't see anyone else able to deliver on such short notice." The hand with the chalkboard lowered.
The full attention of the man's glower focused on Richard for the first time. Men who had heard Richard's words scurried off to attend to important work farther away.
"How much iron did you bring?"
50 bars, 8 feet. The man let out an angry breath.
"I ordered 100. I don't know why they sent an idiot with a wagon when—"
"Do you want to hear the way it is, or do you want to yell at someone? If you just want to spout off to no point and no useful end, then go right ahead, as I'm not much injured by ranting. But when you finally want to hear the truth of the way things are, just let me know, and I'll give it."
The blacksmith peered silently for a moment, a bull bewildered by a bumblebee.
"What's your name?"
"Richard Cipher."
"So, what's the truth of the way things are, Richard Cipher?"
"The foundry wanted to fill the order. They have bar stock stacked to the rafters. They can't get it delivered. They wanted to let me have the whole order, but a transport inspector stationed there wouldn't let us have the whole 100 bars, because the other transport companies are supposed to get their equal loads, but their wagons are broken down."
"So, Ishak's wagons aren't allowed to take more than their fair share, and 50 was their allotment."
"That's right," Richard said.
"At least until the other companies can move some more goods."
The blacksmith nodded.
"The foundry is dying to sell me all the iron I can use, but I can't get it here. I'm not allowed to transport it, to put transport workers like you out of work."
"Were it up to me," Richard said, "I'd go back for another load today. But they told me they couldn't give me any more until next week at the earliest. I'd suggest you get every transport company you can find to deliver you a wagon load. That way you'll have a better chance to get what you need." The blacksmith smiled for the first time. It was amusement at the foolishness of Richard's idea.
"Don't you suppose I already thought of that? I've got orders in with them all. Ishak is the only one with equipment at the moment. The rest are all having wagon problems, horse problems, or worker problems.
At least I have 50 bars for you."
"That will only keep me going the rest of the day and for the morning." The blacksmith turned. "This way. I'll show you where you can stack it."
He led Richard through the congested workshop among the confusion of work and material. They went through a door and down a short connecting hall. The noise fell away behind. They entered a quiet building in back, attached but set off on its own. The blacksmith unhooked a line attached to the cleat and let down a trapdoor covering a window in the roof. Light cascaded down into the center of the large room, where stood a huge block of marble. Richard stood staring at the stunning stone heart of a mountain. It seemed completely out of place in a blacksmith's workshop. There were tall doors at the far end, where the monolith had been brought in on skids. The rest of the room had space left open all around the towering stone. Chisels of every sort and various sized mallets stuck up from slots along the pitch-black walls.
"You can put the bars in here on the side. Be careful when you bring them in."
Richard blinked. He had almost forgotten the man was there with him. Still, he stared at the lustrous quality of the stone before him. "I'll be careful," he said without looking at the blacksmith. "I won't bang it into the stone." As the man started to leave, Richard asked, "I told you my name. What's yours?"
"Casella."
"Is there more to it?"
"Yes. Mister, see that you use it all."
Richard smiled as he followed the man out.
"Yes, sir, Mr. Casella."
Mind if I ask what this is?" The blacksmith slowed to a stop and turned back. He gazed at the marble standing in the light as if it were a woman he loved.
"This is none of your business, that's what it is."
Richard nodded. "I only ask because it's a beautiful piece of stone. I've never seen marble before. It was a statue or made into something." Mr. Casella watched Richard watching the stone.
"There's marble all over this site. Thousands of tons of it. This is just one small piece. Now, get my shorted order of iron unloaded."
By the time Richard was done, he was soaked in sweat and filthy. not only from the iron bars, but from the soot of the blacksmith shop. He asked if he could use some of the water in a rain barrel that the men were using to wash in as they were getting ready to leave for the day. They told him to go ahead. When he finished, Richard found Mr. Casella back at the chalkboard, alone in the suddenly silent shop, making corrections to the drawing and writing numbers down the side. "Mr. Casella, I'm finished. I kept the bars well off to the side, away from the marble."
"Thank you," he mumbled.
"Mind if I ask what you will have to pay for that 50 bars of iron?" The glare was back.
"What's it to you?"
From what I heard at the foundry, the man there had been hoping to fill the whole order so he could get 3.5 gold marks. So, since you got half your order, I believe you will be paying 1.75 gold marks for the 50 bars of iron. Am I correct?" The glare darkened.
"Like I said, what's it to you?"
Richard put his hands in his back pockets. "Well, I was wondering if you would be willing to buy another 50 bars for 1.5 gold marks."
"So, you're a thief, too."
"No, Mr. Casella, I'm not a thief."
"Then how are you going to sell me iron for a quarter mark less than the foundry is selling it for? You smelting a little iron ore in your room at night, Mr. Richard Cipher? Do you want to hear what I have to say, or not?"
His mouth twisted in annoyance.
"Talk."
"The foundry man was furious because he wasn't allowed to transport your whole order. He has more iron than he can sell because he isn't allowed to transport it, and the transport companies are all jammed up so they aren't showing up. He said he would be willing to sell it to me for less."
"Why?"
"He needs the money. He showed me his coal blast furnaces. He owes wages and needs charcoal and ore and quicksilver, among other things, but he hasn't enough money to buy it all. The only thing he has plenty of is smelted metal. His business is strangling because he can't move his product. I asked what price he would be willing to sell me iron for if he didn't have to transport it, if I picked it up myself. He told me that if I came after dark, he would sell me 50 bars for 1.25 gold marks. If you're willing to buy it from me for 1.5, I'll have you another 50 bars by morning, when you said you need it." The man gaped as if Richard was a bar of iron that had just come to life before his eyes, and started talking.
"You know I'm willing to pay 1¾. Why would you offer to sell it to me for 1½?
"Because," Richard explained, "I want to sell it for less than you'd have to pay through a transport company, so that you'll buy it from me instead. And because I need you to loan me the 1¼ gold marks first, so I can buy the bars in the first place and bring them to you. The foundry will only sell them to me if I pay when I come to take them."
"What's to keep you from disappearing with my 1¼ gold marks?"
"My word." The man barked a laugh.
"Your word? I don't know you."
"I told you. My name is Richard Cipher. Ishak is scared to death of you, and he trusted me to get you the iron so you won't come to wring his neck." Mr. Casella smiled again.
"I'd not wring Ishak's neck. I like the fellow. He's stuck in a tight spot. But don't you tell him I said that. I'd like to keep him on his toes."
Richard shrugged. "If you don't want me to, I won't tell him you know how to smile. I know, though, that you're in a tighter spot than Ishak. You have to deliver goods for the order, but you're at the mercy of their methods." He smiled again.
"So, Richard Cipher, what time will you be here with your wagon?"
"I don't have a wagon. But if you agree, I'll have your 50 iron bars right there." Richard pointed at a spot out the double doors beside where Jory had parked the wagon, in a pile, by dawn. Mr. Casella frowned.
"If you don't have a wagon, how are you going to get the bars here? Walk?"
"That's right."
"Are you out of your mind?"
"I don't have a wagon, and I want to earn the money. It's not all that far. I figure I can carry 5 at a time. That only makes 10 trips. I can do that by dawn. I'm used to walking."
Tell me the rest of it, why you want to do this. The truth now.
My wife isn't getting enough to eat. The workers' group assesses most of my wages since I'm able to produce, and gives it to those who don't work. Because I can work, I've become a slave to those who can't, or who don't wish to. Their methods encourage people to find an excuse to let others take care of them. I intensely dislike being a slave. I figure I can entice you to go along with the deal by offering you a better price. We each gain a benefit, value for value.
If I were to go along, what do you plan to do with all that money? Go live off it for a while? Drink it away?
I need the money to buy a wagon and a team of horses.
The frown knotted tighter. What do you need with a wagon?
I need the wagon to deliver you all the iron you're going to buy from me, because I can get it for you cheaper, and because I can deliver it when you need it.
You looking to get buried in the sky?
Richard smiled. No. I just happen to think that the Emperor wants his palace built. From what I've heard, they have a lot of slave labor down there, people they've captured. But they don't have enough slave labor to do it all for them. They need people like you and the foundries.
If the officials of the Order want to have the work progress and not have to explain to Emperor Jagang why it isn't, they will be inclined to look the other way. In that narrow crack of need, there is opportunity.
I expect I'll have to bribe a few officials to get them to be busy elsewhere when I come to pick up loads, but I've already figured that cost into it. I'll be acting on behalf of myself, not an established transport company, so they will be more inclined to see this as a way of accomplishing what they need without suspending their morass of restrictions. You will be getting iron for less than you pay now, and I can deliver. You can't even get what you need at the higher price. You will make more, too. We both benefit.
The blacksmith stared for a moment as he tried to find a flaw in Richard's plan. You're either the stupidest crook I ever saw, or the... I don't even know what. But I have Brother Narev breathing down my neck, and that isn't pleasant. Not pleasant at all. I probably shouldn't tell you this, but you know how Ishak sweats over me. I sweat 10 times that much when Brother Narev comes to ask why the tools aren't ready. The brothers don't want to hear my troubles. They just want what they want.
I understand, Mr. Casella. He let out a sigh.
All right, Richard Cipher. 1.5 gold marks for 50 bars delivered by dawn tomorrow. But I'll only give you the 1.25 now. You get the other 1/4 mark in the morning when my iron is here.
Agreed. Who is this Brother Narev, anyway?
Brother Narev? He's the high priest.
Did I hear someone mention my name? The voice was deep enough to nearly rattle the tools off the walls. Richard and the blacksmith turned to see a man approaching from around the corner of the shop. Here and there his heavy robes betrayed his large, bony frame. His face seemed to pull the gathering darkness into the deep creases of his face. Dark eyes gleamed out from under a hooded brow, overspread with a tangle of graying hairs. Wiry hair above his ears curled up from under the edges of a dark, creased cap. The cap sat halfway down his forehead. He looked like a shadow come to life to stalk the world. Mr. Casella bowed. Richard followed his lead.
We were just discussing the problem of getting enough iron, Brother Narev.
Where are all my new chisels, blacksmith?
I have yet to...
I have stone sitting down there with no chisels to cut it. I have stone cutters who need more tools. You are holding up my palace.
The blacksmith lifted a hand toward Richard.
This is Richard Cipher, Brother Narev. He was just telling me how he thought he might be able to get me the iron I need, and...
The high priest held up his hand for silence.
You can get the blacksmith what he needs, Brother Narev snapped at Richard.
It can be done.
Then do it.
Richard bowed his head. By your command, Brother Narev.
The shadowed figure turned to the shop.
"Show me, blacksmith."
The blacksmith seemed to know what the high priest wanted and followed behind him, gesturing for Richard to come along. Richard understood. He couldn't get the money to buy the iron until the blacksmith first took care of the important man who had just vanished into the shadows of the shop. When the blacksmith snapped his fingers and pointed at a lamp on his way by, Richard snatched it up. He lit a long splinter in the glowing coals of the forge and then lit the lamp. He held it up behind the two men as they stood just inside the doorway to the room with the complex contraption of metal bars sitting on the floor beyond. Mr. Casella held the chalkboard up in the light. Brother Narev looked at the drawing on the chalkboard, then to the maze of iron lines on the floor, comparing them. Richard felt an icy tingle at the base of his scalp when he suddenly realized what the thing on the floor was. Brother Narev pointed to the drawing, to the line Richard had said was wrong.
"This line is wrong," Brother Narev growled.
The blacksmith wagged his finger over the chalk drawing.
"But I have to stabilize this mass over here."
"I told you to add braces. I didn't invite you to ruin the main scheme. You can leave the top of the support where you have it, but the bottom should be attached here."
Brother Narev pointed to where Richard had said it should go. Mr. Casella scratched his head of short hair as he stole a glance over his shoulder, just long enough to scowl at Richard.
"That would work," the blacksmith conceded. "It won't be as easy, but it will work."
"I'm not concerned with how easy it is," Brother Narev said with menace. "I don't want anything attached to this area here."
"No, sir."
"It must be seamless, so none of the joining work shows through when it is covered in gold. Get me those tools made first."
"Yes, Brother Narev."
The high priest turned an uncomfortable scrutiny on Richard.
"There's something about you. Do I know you?"
"No, Brother Narev. I've never met you before. I would remember. Meeting a great man such as yourself, I mean, I would remember such a thing."
He glared askance at Richard.
"Yes, I suppose you would. You get the blacksmith his iron."
"I said I would."
The brother grunted irritably.
"So you did."
As the tall shadow of a man stared into Richard's eyes, Richard absently reached to lift his sword a little to make sure it was clear in its scabbard. The sword wasn't there. Brother Narev opened his mouth to say something, but his attention was caught by two young men entering the shop. They wore robes like the high priest, but without caps. They had simple hoods pulled up over their heads instead.
"Brother Narev," one called.
"What is it, Neil?"
"The book you sent for has arrived. You asked that we come for you at once."
Brother Narev nodded to the young disciple, then directed a sour look at Mr. Casella and Richard.
"Get it done," he said to both.
Both Richard and the blacksmith bowed their heads as the high priest swept out of the shop. It felt as if a thundercloud had just departed over the horizon.
"Come on," Mr. Casella said. "I'll get you the gold."
Richard followed him into a little room where the master blacksmith pulled out a strong box attached with massive chain fixed to a huge pin in the floor under the plank serving as his desk. He unlocked the strong box and handed Richard a gold mark.
"Victor."
Richard looked up from the gold mark and frowned.
"What?" "Victor. You asked what more there was to my name."
He set silver to make up the quarter mark on top of the gold mark resting in Richard's palm.
"Victor."
Chapter 49. After leaving Ishak's place and before going to get the iron for Victor, Richard rushed back to his room. It wasn't dinner he wanted, but to let Nikki know that he had to go back to work. She had in the past made it clear that they were husband and wife, and that she would take a dim view of him vanishing. He was to remain in Al-Turang and work, just like any other normal man. Camille and one of his friends were waiting for him. Both were wearing shirts. Richard stood at the foot of the stairs, looking up at the two.
"I'm sorry, Camille, but I have to go back to work."
"Then you're a bigger dupe than I thought, taking work at night, too. You should just stop trying. It's no use trying in life. You just have to take what life gives you. I knew you would have an excuse not to do what you said you would do. You almost had me thinking that you might be different then."
"I was going to say that I have to go back to work, so we have to do this right away."
Camille twisted his mouth, as was his habit, to express his displeasure with those older and stupider than he.
"This is Nobby. He wants to watch your foolish labor, too."
Richard nodded, not showing any irritation at Camille's arrogant attitude. "Glad to meet you, Nobby." The third young man glared from the shadows back by the stairs in the hall. He was the biggest. He wasn't wearing a shirt. To pry the steps apart, Richard used his knife and a rusty metal bar Camille found for him. It wasn't difficult. They were ready to fall apart on their own. As the two youths watched Richard clean the grooves in the stringers, since they were chewed up from being loose, he deepened their bottoms, showing the two what he was doing, and explaining how he would bevel the ends of the treads to lock into the deepened channel. Richard watched Camille and Nobby as they whittled wedges to match the one he made as a pattern for them. They were only too delighted to show him their knife work. Richard was delighted that it helped get the job done sooner. Once they had them back together, Camille and Nobby both ran up and down the repaired steps, apparently surprised that they really were now sturdy underfoot, and pleased that they were partly responsible for the repair. "You both did a good job," Richard told them, because they had. They didn't make any smart remarks. They actually smiled. Richard's dinner was a watery millet eaten by the light of a burning wick floating in linseed oil. The smell from the simple light went poorly with the dinner, which was more water than millet. Nicky said she'd already eaten and didn't want any more. She encouraged him to finish it. He didn't give Nicky the details of his second job. She was insistent only that he work. The work itself was irrelevant to her. She tended to her household chores and expected him to earn them a living. She seemed satisfied that he was learning how ordinary people had to work themselves sick just to make enough to get along in life. The promise of money to buy them more food seemed to spark a longing in her eyes that her lips did not express. He noticed that the black material covering her once full bosom was now slack and half empty. Her elbows and hands had become bony. As he took another spoonful of millet, Nicky casually mentioned that the landlord, Camille's father, had come by. Richard looked up from his soup. "What did he say?"
"He said that since you have a job, the area citizens' building committee had assessed us extra rent in order to help pay the rent of those in the local buildings who can't work. You see, Richard, how life under the ways of the order cultivates caring in people, so that we all work together for the benefit of all?"
Nearly all of what was not taken by the workers' group was taken by the area building committee, or some other committee, and all for the same purpose, for the betterment of the people of the order. Richard and Nicky had next to nothing left for food. Richard's clothes were getting looser all the time, but not as loose as Nicky's dresses were getting.
This is the end of Side 1. This program is continued on Side 2 of this cassette.